body falls in the forest and no one finds it, is it really there? Today, police search a wooded area. If a body is here, they are convinced the dog will find it. The search is the culmination of a case that began 2 years ago when a woman placed a frantic call to police. Her husband is missing. But something about that call simply doesn't add up.
We thought this was rather odd. Why did you wait 5 days to call the police after your loved one has gone missing?
In true crime, investigation and conviction may take years. But every detective knows that the crucial clue is always there, somewhere in the first 72 hours. Toronto, 1996. Detective Cindy Grant interviews Natasha Galatis, a woman whose husband has been missing for 5 days.
She was extremely, extremely distraught. Here she is, 8 months pregnant. Her husband is gone. She has no idea where he is. He's literally just vanished off the face of the earth.
But why did she wait 5 days to call police? Natasha says it's because of what happened on the day her husband, Nico, disappeared. He spent the day socializing with his friend and business partner, George Marinucci. A normal day, except thinking back, Natasha believes they were trying to hide something. Nico promised to be home in time for supper.
Bye, guys.
At 11 p.m., Nico was still not home. She called George. George came right over. He produced a number where Nico could be reached. It was not in service. Natasha wanted to call police, but George said no. If you call police, Nico's life is in danger. Natasha says George wouldn't tell her why someone would want to hurt her husband. Detective Grant needs to know. The detective finds George Marinucci in his garden. She wants to know where Nico is and why his life is in danger. George hesitates, but realizes it's time to tell his story. He says that he and Nico have been selling bootleg liquor, usually just a case or two a week. But they were about to make a much bigger deal. They met with a couple of guys who offered them 500 cases at a killer price. Never dealt with players this heavy before. But the deal was too good to pass up. 1 week later, they put their entire savings into a duffel bag, $50,000. The plan was to drive to a secret location to pick up the booze. The front man was edgy. The bootleggers had given him new conditions for their meeting. No weapons, no cell phones. Only one of the buyers could be there. Nico volunteered to go with the front man. Detective Grant wants to know, who are these bootleggers? Who is the front man? George says the one guy's name is David Farino. He never knew for sure. George says that he saw this David guy give Nico an emergency contact number. A number where he could be reached in case his wife went into labor. That was the last time George saw Nico. The last time he spoke to him. The detective wants to know why George stopped Natasha from calling the police for 5 days. He says David, the front man, phoned him and told him that Nico had pissed off the bootleggers. They'd kidnapped him. David said, "We're all dead unless we shut the hell up." Detective Grant doesn't know what, if anything, of George's story is true. If Nico was kidnapped, why has there been no ransom demand? Did the liquor deal go wrong, or did George and Nico have a falling out?
We had absolutely no clue as to what was going on. We knew somebody's missing. There's a very strong possibility that foul play is being suspected. We're 5 days into this, and there's no hide, no hair. There's been nothing.
Detective Grant needs to verify or disprove George's story. She starts at the rental lot. The manager doesn't keep good records, but he has a reason to remember a guy named Nico. Nico was angry because there was no gas in the van. The manager calmed him down by letting him fill up for free. There were two other men with Nico, but the manager didn't get their names. He doesn't have the van either. No one ever brought it back.
All we had was a license plate. And if this license plate was to ever show up, then they could, of course, seize it.
Since the van exists, at least this part of George's story is true. But what about the front man for the liquor deal?
So here we are trying to find somebody where we have a first name, where we have a phonetic sounding of a last name. He gives phone numbers, which are untraceable. From there, we have to try and scour the far reaches of Ontario to try and find who and where this person is.
For 8 months, police pound the pavement, make thousands of phone calls. Finally, after much searching, they find the home of a man named David Fiorino. Records show that he purchased the home recently for himself and his new wife. Detective Grant questions David about any involvement he may have had with Nico Galatis. David says he doesn't know anyone named Nico. He knows nothing about an illegal liquor deal. On July 2nd, the day Nico went missing, David and his wife were at the family cottage. David's story conflicts with what the detective suspects. Is David lying to cover up illegal activities, or is he afraid to tell the truth?
The day that David was interviewed, his house was being watched by the police, and suddenly this person shows up. Isn't that interesting? He's a bigger stature man.
Detective Grant shows the surveillance pictures to George and Natasha. George recognizes the big man. At the donut shop meeting, he was David's silent partner. Chances are good he knows what happened to Nico. Or maybe he made it happen. Police suspect foul play in the disappearance of Nico Galatis. They have reason to believe that this man, who has been spotted while doing a surveillance operation, is involved. They have identified him as landscape contractor Tony Cordasco. She tells Tony she knows he's involved in bootleg liquor deals with David Fiorino. And she's checked his phone records. He talked to David for 15 minutes on the day Nico Galatis disappeared. And she wants to know his connection to the missing man. Tony says she's got it all wrong. Sure, he knows David, but their relationship is not what she thinks.
Tony turned out to be an ex-boss of David. David had actually worked for him a year prior, and I guess it kept up somewhat of a friendship with him.
Tony says he went to the donut shop as a favor. David was about to make some big deal and needed to look like he had some muscle.
It was a bit of a joke to Tony, just playing a part.
What about the 15-minute call on the day Nico vanished?
Tony says David was just shooting the breeze. He didn't say what he was doing, didn't say where he was.
Tony's story could be true, but he could be lying to cover up his involvement in a major crime. Either way, the detective has ways to find out where Nico and David were headed on the day Nico disappeared. Cell phone records log more than time and duration. They log the approximate location of the call. Detective Grant uses this information to track David Fiorino's movements as he spoke to Tony from the rental van. David ended the call on this lonely stretch of highway. A search of the area reveals no buildings where liquor could be stored. A few days later, police get a lucky break. The rental company has located the missing van, abandoned in a parking lot in a nearby small town.
We checked it for blood, for fingerprints. There was nothing on it. Absolutely nothing on it.
But the detective is not finished with this piece of evidence. She remembers Nico's partner said the liquor deal was for 500 cases. She checks the weight of the cases versus the load capacity of the van.
We did some measuring, and of course we found out no way under this moon could that vehicle hold 500 cases of liquor.
500 cases, nearly 10 tons.
Probably would have blown out the tires completely. It's physically impossible.
This leads Detective Grant to one conclusion. There never was going to be any liquor deal. If there never was a liquor deal, what happened to George and Nico's $50,000? Detective Grant gains access to bank records for everyone involved in the case.
We found that on the day after our victim went missing, that David had in fact gone to his local bank with just shy of $27,000 in cash, and he had paid off some debts.
The detective canvasses David's old neighborhood and discovers he also purchased a new truck. The seller remembers David Fiorino very well. It's hard to forget a flashy guy in his 20s who pays for a $12,000 truck with cold, hard cash.
So now you have within 2 days of this $50,000 gone missing, our victim going missing, you have a good hunk of that money has been spent by David.
It's looking more and more like Nico was murdered for money, and David may be the only person who knows where the body is. The detective obtains a warrant for a wiretap. In one call, David's wife mentions they are planning a camping trip.
We had made arrangements that we would have an undercover officer go in there and befriend him and his wife and see what that friendship would bring about.
The undercover officer plays the role of an up-and-coming drug dealer and talks about his heavy underworld connections.
So David's thinking, this bad guy is just like me. So he thinks.
David boasts about a lucrative liquor deal where one of the men involved was killed. He says the guy who died was a sucker. The undercover officer can't get David to reveal any more details. Not who killed him, not where the body is buried. Maybe David is too smart to talk about the murder of Nico Galatis with anyone. Or maybe the detective just needs to find the right bait. Detective Grant suspects David Fiorino is involved in the disappearance and possible murder of Nico Galatis. But Nico's body has not been found. No body, no case. The detective plans to trick David into telling her where it is.
She sends in the undercover officer with a wire. He tells his good buddy, David, he wants to get rid of a rival drug dealer. He's never killed before and needs to know how to dispose of a body. He's willing to pay big money for advice, but only to a real killer. David boasts he's the man. The undercover officer wants proof. David shows him a police poster of Nico Galatis.
He comes out to say to our undercover officer, oh, this is something that I was involved in, and this is my souvenir of that.
He says he's never told anyone before, not even his wife. He didn't have the heart to tell her he'd killed someone so he could put a diamond ring on her finger. The detective gets it all on tape. But if she presents this evidence in court, David can claim he was lying about being a murderer to impress the undercover officer. Without corroborating evidence, without the location of the body, police have no chance of a conviction. The detective decides to turn up the heat. She brings in Tony Cordasco for questioning. She tells Tony, like it or not, he's involved. Tony took a 15-minute call from David around the time Nico disappeared. Detective Grant knows Tony's still holding back on her, but she has no cause to detain him when he asks to leave. She manages to get him alone on his way out.
I asked him, I said, do you know more than you're telling us? And he did indicate to me that, yes, he did know more. He was also afraid if he said too much that he and his family would be in jeopardy.
David had told him that the bootleggers would kill anyone who talked with police. Detective Grant tells Tony that David lied to him. There never was any liquor deal. There never were any dangerous bootleggers. Tony realizes he's been played for a fool, and he decides to come clean.
He did indicate to me that he knew where our victim was.
He takes the detective to a wooded area close to the last known location of David's cell phone call. Tony is adamant he had nothing to do with the disappearance of Nico and that he'll testify to that effect in court. Detective Grant calls in a search unit with specially trained cadaver-sniffing dogs.
When you're looking at the decomposition of human remains, there's going to be a leaching of body fluids into the soil. That scent is what the dog is trying to locate.
The dogs can only smell a body buried close to the surface. The searchers know it may be deeper.
Basically, all we're doing is venting the potential area and allowing the dog to get access to the scent.
10 potential sites are probed.
As I deployed the dog on the probe holes, on the middle one, the dog started making an indication, which is a dig and a bark, and that tells me that he's getting the scent of human remains.
A backhoe starts to dig, very carefully, removing a few inches of the surface at a time.
As we got down further and further, you know, our olfactory, you know, our sense of smell was able to pick up the scent, and the dog just was going crazy.
Inch by inch, the ground is taken back, taken back, taken back, and eventually 6 feet under, there we find actually the shoulder of our victim.
The body has been buried for 19 months. It is badly decomposed. Investigators find a wallet and the driver's license of Nico Galatis. Detective Grant visits Nico's wife, now bringing up a baby boy who will never know his father. She tells Natasha the news she has been expecting, dreading, for almost 2 years.
She had always said that there was this small, small glimmer of hope that maybe he was out there and that he was alive. And that news that me telling her that we had found him and he wasn't indeed passed on, that was the final closure. he was gone.
The same day, Detective Grant arrests David Fiorino on a charge of first-degree murder. She is prepared to testify in court and to present a compelling scenario of the crime. When Nico kissed his wife goodbye, he thought the bootleg liquor deal was a step up in the world of big crime. It was, but not for him. Police don't know how David Fiorino murdered Nico. But they believe that within a few hours of leaving the van rental lot, he was burying Nico's body. David Fiorino had motive, $50,000 worth. He thought that he could get away with murder. He nearly did. But he made one wrong move. He mentioned his real name to Nico and George. And even though George could not remember the name accurately, this small piece of information gathered just a few hours after the investigation began led to Fiorino's demise. On the basis of the investigation and testimony by Detective Cindy Grant, the court found David Fiorino guilty of first-degree murder. The stories on 72 Hours are true. The detectives and forensic scientists are the ones who actually worked on the case. The names of the victims are fictitious. The names of the convicted are real.